Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news and begin in a moment and discuss the foreign policy of George W. Bush, firstly with David Armstrong, who is the Bureau Chief for the National Security News Service in Washington, D.C., and the author of an article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, Dick Cheney's Song of America, Drafting a Plan for Global Dominance. And we'll be talking also with Tom Carruthers, who's the director of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., for a somewhat different view on George Bush's foreign policy. And then we'll talk about Venezuela, where in the last week or so there's been about half a million people banging pots in the streets and demonstrations and counter-demonstrations and a general paralysis. And we're getting a sense of what's going on in terms of what hand the United States government may be having in trying to topple Hugo Chavez, the leader in Venezuela, which, of course, is the fifth largest oil supplier in the world and about the second largest oil supplier to the United States. We're talking about what happened to Otto Reich, the Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, whose job position seems to be in question. We'll be talking, in fact, with Arturo Valenzuela, who's the former senior director for Latin America at the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. He's now the director of the Center for Latin American Studies at Georgetown University. And we'll be talking to Arturo about, in general, about what's going on there, the United States' hand in it, and the extent to which Hugo Chavez has been blown up into a villain, and the situation in Venezuela is hardly comparable to what happened in Chile in the 70s when the military took over there. We'll be talking about in general, where it may lead. But let's now begin with an overview of the Bush administration's, at least the George W. Bush administration's, view on the world and the extent to which there is a blueprint for global dominance. I'm speaking with David Armstrong, who's the Bureau Chief of the National Security News Service, and he has an article in this current issue of Harper's Magazine, Dick Cheney's Song of America, Drafting a Plan for Global Dominance. And the plan is not as quite as Disney-esque as Song of America.
That's right. It's a plan that really is aimed at securing American dominance throughout the world at the military level, at the economic level, at the political level. And it's a plan that has very little to do with the current situation. It's really a plan that grew out of the end of the Cold War and attempt to solidify U.S. dominance at that stage. It had to be shelved during the Clinton administration when they did not pick up on this grand scheme that Cheney, Wolfowitz, and Powell had devised, but has come back into play in the post-September 11th environment.
So this is like it's been sitting around in the playbook. It's like what happened with Grenada, where the Marines were blown up in Lebanon. They needed something to take the attention off the headlines of this debacle. And Oliver North pulled out of the drawer a plan to invade Grenada that was just sitting there.
Well, I think it's a little bit different than that. I think this is something that they truly hoped to have implemented back in the early 90s. It was something that was drafted during the 1991-92 period with the collapse of the Soviet Union. They attempted to actually put it into place during the first Bush administration at that point. It met with very bad reviews. People saw through it. It was seen for what it was, essentially a plan for U.S. hegemony, and met with very bad reviews at that stage. With an election coming up, they knew that they wouldn't play well. They put it on the sidelines for a while, and then when Bush lost the election, issued the scheme as a white paper in the closing days of the first Bush administration, sort of a parting shot and a suggestion to Clinton for a strategy to follow. He clearly did not. He chose globalism over global dominance, and the plan essentially sat unused for the duration. During the early stages of the current Bush administration, there were evidence of particular elements of this plan coming back into play. Missile defense being one of the most prominent, but also the hardening of relations with China, with Korea, and other nations. It wasn't until September 11th, however, that the real impetus for putting the full plan back on the table emerged. And over the course of the past year or so, the administration has very articulated the various elements. But it wasn't until the National Security Strategy was issued last month that it became clear that the original plan, as drafted by Wolfowitz, Powell, Cheney, was really going to become policy in its full form.
And give us a picture of when this plan was drafted and the conditions. And you know, I mean, it sounds cabalistic, but give me a picture of it.
Well, essentially, it was with declining budgets, Powell began to realize that there was going to have to be some way of preserving U.S. military budgets without, a traditional enemy. And he began floating various schemes for multiple theater warfare, for preserving U.S. Cold War level military structures without necessarily having the full advantage of the budgets that had existed throughout the Cold War. Once the Soviet Union collapsed, however, that's really when sort of Wolfowitz and Cheney added their element of vision to this. That is, this sense that this was sort of America's imperial moment, that the United States was unconstrained at that point without any countervailing force. The United States could really exert its will without having to worry about what a superpower adversary might try to quibble away at. And the strategy was really to lock in place U.S. dominance and, in their terms, make sure that no new rival existed to challenge the United States at any level on the world stage. And that meant ensuring that allies and foes alike did not develop militarily, economically, politically in ways that could be a challenge to U.S. dominance. That, of course, was seen essentially for what it was by world leaders. It was denounced heavily in the spring of 1992 and essentially abandoned, at least for in the public arena, throughout the summer and fall of 1992. And it wasn't until the very last days of the first Bush administration in January of 1993 that Cheney issued the full-fledged plan once again as a policy paper. Of course, at that stage, it was a little late to be adopted as policy, and it really sat throughout the Clinton presidency, while Cheney, Powell, and Wolfowitz sort of sat on the sidelines hectoring the president for failure to act as vigorously as they would have preferred and as their plan suggested he should.
But since the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union, Pax Americana is a de facto fact, right? I mean,
well, that's the case. But what this plan is about is preserving that, ensuring, as they say, that no new rivals emerge. It's not just a question of what the facts are on the ground. It's a question of what the United States is going to allow to permit to develop. In other words, allies can come along and join under a U.S.-led umbrella organization in pursuing an agenda that the United States sets, but they are not free under this vision to pursue their own interests against the will of the United States. Anybody who wants to play ball and go along with this plan is welcome to do so and would benefit from U.S. protection. Anyone who does not, however, would be on the business end of it, essentially.
So what happened to George W.'s pledge in his first debate with Al Gore that we would have a humble foreign policy?
Well, when you put Paul Wolfowitz in the second position in the Pentagon, when you put you know, Doug Feist and some of the other ideologues who he stacked his administration with, it's very hard to think that you're going to end up with anything humble. These are people who are quite rabid in their foreign policy visions. Their views are on record going all the way back to the 1960s, when Richard Perle and Wolf Blitz in particular, as advocating exactly the policy that has now emerged. It's therefore unsurprising when you have a president who is essentially sort of a mouthpiece for ideas that are developed at you know, the cabinet level, that he would end up moving toward plans that reflect the views of the people who he's put into those senior positions. This is the only, many people refer to the new national security strategy as a new plan. It is not. It is a plan that has been in various iterations around for at least 12 years, and if you trace it back to its intellectual origins, really since the 1960s.
Well, but the key, though, to the neocons that, you know, you mentioned, Doug Feith and Perle, it's Wolfowitz, Roche, Rodman, Bolton. They're all throughout the state and key positions in state, and particularly in defense, at the deputy level, which is where the flow of information comes from. I mean, that's the key level of controlling the agenda.
Absolutely, and this is exactly why whatever Bush may have said, this was inevitable that we were going to see a plan of this nature eventually become policy. It was clear early on in the administration that while it wasn't unified enough to be considered a plan, that the various elements of this kind of a structure, the pieces necessary to implement this kind of a plan, were all coming together. It was only after September 11th, though, that they began to articulate the overarching vision that unified all of those various elements, created the structure that eventually became the articulated view in the national security strategy.
Well, it's not difficult to see the current situation with Iraq in the light of this document that you're talking about. If it's true that the Bush administration made deals with the Chinese, the French, and the Russians for long-term oil contracts, mortgaging Iraqi oil before they even have it, the Iraqi people apparently, as much as you can poll them, they believe that we're not bringing democracy, we're out to get their oil. This is a situation where the biggest guy on the block is knocking off this piece of, I can't say the word, this tiny little country run by a psycho. It's a terrible situation, but nevertheless, there's a lot of terrible countries and terrible leaders around the world.
Iraq is a test case. There's nothing more
right
to it than that. This way of demonstrating that the United States is willing to implement this plan, to defy world opinion, to assert its own will, and to follow its own agenda, regardless of what anybody else thinks. And where you have a case, as you say, with a psycho, with a universally agreed upon, sort of Hollywood bad guy, it's very easy to get people to go along on this sort of thing. The question becomes, what happens when you turn to other cases where there's less unanimity of opinion on the subject? What happens when you get into situations where you're talking about, more traditional U.S. allies having reservations about the plan? It's tough enough with Iraq to get everybody on the same page, but this is the United States essentially asserting its will. The other problem with this plan, of course, is that it's such a terrible example for other countries that in trying to consolidate power, the United States may be creating the very kind of fragmentation and diversity that it's trying to avoid. If India decides to use this same strategy against Pakistan, if China decides to use it against Taiwan, Australia is already making noises about asserting its force, beyond its own borders on a unilateral basis, preemptively. The British have done much the same thing. What you have is a lot of countries following on a smaller scale this same plan and potentially creating more problems than exist at the moment. I think that beyond that, there's also the question of the backlash to this, that the resentments, the hostilities, that this sort of assertion of U.S. force is going to create will you know, just exacerbate the hatreds that create the kind of people who fly planes into buildings to begin with. We may see just a further escalation of the kind of violence, of the kind of hatred that we presumably are out to stifle.
Well, just in closing, David Armstrong, surely this is, if the U.S., I mean, you cannot steal a country in plain sight. I mean, it's not as if the United States is going to get away with that. If it's not about building democracy, if it's about grabbing oil, it's going to be incredibly clear to everybody in the world. There's already a lot of anti-Americanism out there. The Pew Research people did a study all around the world, right next door in Canada. I mean, anti-Americanism is a growing and probably the most the most difficult and challenging problem the United States has.
I would differ on the question of whether it's about stealing oil. I don't believe that it's necessarily about stealing oil, nor do I. But on the other hand, I agree with you that it's not about building democracy either. It's about the U.S. proving that it can assert its will. That's what it's about. It's sending a message to the rest of the world saying, as Bush said about the terrorists, you're with us or you're with the terrorists. Either you're on the page with us or else you're not. And if you're not, then you could be next on the list. If you play ball, then you will receive the benefits of being on our team, technology transfers, missile defense, money. If you're not, then potentially you are going to end up on the business end of this policy, and that's a scary situation for anybody who finds themselves there.
But at the end of the day, it seems to me that so far this administration has unified and emboldened and dignified America's enemies and divided and alienated America's allies. And if this policy doctrine that you write about in the current issue of Harper's, Dave Armstrong, is the blueprint, as it appears to be, and it's enacted, we're going to have more people hating us, and our friends are going to hate us as well. So
this is
not good for American security, though, is it?
This is the sort of imperial vision that these people have. They are unconcerned with world opinion. They are unconcerned. They believe that they can crush dissent and that they don't have to work, and that everybody else can be cowed into coming along. Essentially, you're absolutely correct in your characterization of how this might play out. The question is whether this administration is concerned about that. They seem not to be.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, David Armstrong.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with David Armstrong, who is the Bureau Chief for the National Security News Service in Washington, D.C., and the author of an article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, Dick Cheney's Song of America, Drafting a Plan for Global Dominance. Let's now turn to another view of the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration's foreign policy, and the extent to which it contains inherent contradictions. I'm speaking with Thomas Carruthers, who directs the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and you have an article coming out in the forthcoming issue of Foreign Affairs in which you suggest that the United States faces two contradictory imperatives. On the one hand, the fight against al-Qaeda tempts Washington to put aside its democratic scruples and seek closer ties with autocracies throughout the Middle East and Asia. On the other hand, U.S. officials and policy experts have increasingly come to believe that it's precisely the lack of democracy in many of these countries that helps breed Islamic extremism. And, of course, Colin Powell addressed that at the Heritage Foundation on Thursday, saying that the United States should focus on economic and educational development in the Middle East. Is this too little too late?
Well, to some extent, we have a short-term, long-term issue here. In the short term, today, tomorrow, next month, throughout next year, we need the cooperation of a number of regimes that are not democratic in the war on terror, particularly Pakistan, but also Malaysia and a number of regimes in the Middle East, like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. At the same time, the administration wants to start undertaking some measures to at least open up the possibility of greater democracy or some real democracy in the Middle East. So what Secretary Powell did was the start, and it's really only the start, and a small one at that, of some initiatives by the United States to try to do that. It is little, it is late, but better little and better late than never. So I think that's where we are.
And how much is the focus on Iraq clouding the at least the war on terrorism?
Well, some people think it clarifies it, and other people think it clouds it. Some people think it clarifies it in the sense that they feel that if the United States can remove Saddam Hussein from power, this removes yet another source of terrorism and a potential partner who could ally with elements in al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Other people think it's a distraction. I think they're only loosely related, the potential war against Iraq and the war against al-Qaeda, but I think the United States probably is capable of doing both, since the war on al-Qaeda at this point is more of a law enforcement and intelligence challenge than it is a military one, whereas the war in Iraq will be largely a military challenge, at least in its initial phase.
And then we have to add to the mix the possibility of mischief from North Korea. So it's not as if the United States is able to control events.
No, there's no stop the world I want to get off here. I mean, and you're right, at one time when the United States is very occupied with events in one region, people in another place like North Korea think, this is the time to take advantage of this, maybe to sell some more missiles, stir up a little bit more trouble, get our nuclear program going. So, in a sense, you're right, problems are multiplying even as our efforts to combat them are multiplying.
And Thomas Carruthers, in terms of the Mideast and the post 9/11 recognition that that in a sense, I mean, let me just pose this thesis: aren't we faced here with a software problem vis-a-vis Al Qaeda and the war on terrorism? Can you stop hatred with weapons?
Well, I agree with you, and that what we have, the hatred against the United States that's motivating some of these extreme groups isn't something that you can stop with weapons. You can try to stop them with weapons, or, say, with essentially international law enforcement-type measures. But you're right, there's a deeper problem, is that a number of people in the Islamic world are very angry at the United States for a number of reasons. They're angry at the West, and they're extremely hostile to many forms of Western civilization. And this isn't, in a sense, a military problem. It's a deeper problem we have with cultures that have decided they're against us or they feel that we're against them. So we do need a broader campaign to change our relationship with the Islamic world, or particularly certain countries where we've been aligned with authoritarian leaders or done things that have really irritated people, such as our military presence in some countries like in Saudi Arabia.
Well, but the thing that seems to be radical, at least if that's maybe too strong a word, with George W. Bush's approach, and it's worth noting that most of the critics to George W. Bush's approach vis-a-vis Iraq and the expected effect that it will have on Saudi Arabia, the critics have been largely from his father's regime, if not his father himself. And there hasn't been any criticism from the left so much as from the more traditional Republican foreign policy.
Well, the mainstream of the Democratic Party is afraid of challenging the president on the war in Iraq because they look back to the last time, the 1990-91 crisis with Iraq, and they felt later the Democrats got punished if they opposed the war. So interestingly, precisely as you point out, most of the opposition has come from within, or at least hesitancy has come within moderate parts of the Republican Party, Senator Hagel, Senator Lugar, the president's father, and then, of course, people further to the left of the mainstream Democratic Party who don't feel worried about being punished for their opposition to the war, but those tend not to have strong representatives in Congress. So you're right, most of the questioning that's going on is actually within the Republican Party and within the sort of the Bush family. So,
And I guess the bottom line is that George W. is prepared to break the china here, right? He's prepared to let the chips fall as they may.
Well, he hasn't shown that he may be, but he's hesitating here. I mean, Iraq is in the middle of this inspections process, and the president is going to face a very, very difficult decision within 1 month, 2 months, maybe 3 months about how does the United States judge this inspections process? Do we feel it's gone far enough? Do we feel it's authentic? And I think it's too early to say that the president is going to break the china, as it were. He may, and I think he's probably has a willingness to do so. But he hasn't done that yet, so I don't think we should say yes, that it's definite that he will, because it's, in a sense, a roll of the dice of his presidency if he attacks Iraq. If it goes well, we can almost guarantee that he would be reelected. If it goes poorly, his presidency would be in serious question in 2004.
And in terms of the so-called Arab Street, I mean, advisors from the Bush senior administration are saying go lightly and not have the backlash, and therefore we'll, you know, these, as you refer to in your article, these friendly tyrants will be toppled by their own street. First of all, isn't that a little overplayed? I mean, they've managed to sit on their street for a long time.
Yeah, I think there are two different ideas or theses about what might happen in the rest of the Arab world if the United States attacks Iraq. Some people, and particularly neoconservatives around the president or in the administration, feel that political change in Iraq might be democratic and might set off a positive example and a positive wave of democratic political change in other Arab countries. The other view is that an attack on Iraq will cause a wave of increase the wave of anti-Americanism that's being felt in the region, and will cause protests both against existing regimes, such as in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and against the United States. And this will, if anything, put pressure on these governments to hunker down, repress further, and try to maintain their hold. I'm more of the latter view, and I think what we see in most of the Arab world is a sense of political pressure on a number of regimes, and these regimes would clamp down. But you're right, they're probably capable of surviving. Places like the governments in Egypt and Saudi Arabia have shown themselves able to ride roughshod over domestic dissent for a long time, and they'd probably be able to do so in that coming period as well.
And in terms of the neoconservatives' idea of bringing democracy to Iraq, first of all, I can't imagine how you know democracy is not something that you can bring in a package. It doesn't, and you've got. I mean, this war, I think, is if it takes place, it'll probably be over in a few days. But then that's the day after is what we should be focusing on, surely. You've got the two Iraqi factions, you've got the Sunni and the Shia, you've got this overlay of retribution from this 23 years of murder and torture, that there's going to be the Tikriti clan is going to be wiped out, the Special Republican Guards, there'll be this bloodletting, this tribal payback. That doesn't look like a fertile field for democracy.
No, it's not going to be a Jeffersonian fiesta. I think it's possible that the United States can improve basically political life in Iraq if we have relatively modest expectations. But you're right, if Saddam Hussein is driven out of power, there's going to be an initial period where the country's going to be badly in need of some stability and somebody with a relatively firm hand to keep order in that situation, which the Kurds are pulling one way, the Shiites in another, and as you say, other kinds of clan-oriented retribution going on. So probably our initial instinct, as in a sense post-war occupiers, would be to find some group of people within Iraq who can really take a firm hand on the country and run it for a while, and that's different from democracy. The question is whether or not there'd be any chance of putting in place, after that firm government was established, some pluralistic processes, some kinds of perhaps national dialogues or constitutional rewriting or initial local elections, something to start opening up the political system. But at best, it's a very long-term process. Iraq is not going to go from the sort of putrid, rotten, and repressive politics of the last 30 years into democracy overnight. At best, it's going to be a process of years and decades. And at worst, it could be repressive, it could be violent, it could be divisive, and some pretty ugly things could happen.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Thomas Carruthers, who directs the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and he has an article in the forthcoming issue of Foreign Affairs, Promoting Democracy and Fighting Terror. There's the dichotomy here. So you've got George W. Bush with this sort of schizophrenic foreign policy. On the one hand, he's got this faith-based belief in good versus evil, but he's also acts as in the tradition of realpolitik, where the country acts according to its interests, not according to its ideals. And you're talking about this sort of struggle for his soul, or I mean, is it a struggle for his soul, or just to get some sort of definition? I mean, or is it about these personalities, where you've got Powell pushing one way and Rumsfeld and Cheney pushing the other, and Condoleezza Rice trying to be the traffic cop?
Well, in a deeper sense, we could go back in the Republican Party to, you know, Goldwater versus Rockefeller, and see a long-standing tendency in the Republican Party to, for there to be a division between moderates and more hardline elements. And we see that carrying through to the 1980s, 1990s, with the difference between Ronald Reagan and the first George Bush president. And though that dualism or dichotomy is in some ways embodied in one person, in George Bush Jr., that he has father's legacy of realism and kind of moderation in a certain sense, but he seems to have another stripe in him, which in some ways challenges that his father's legacy and the desire to define himself differently. And because of the born-again nature, which is actually quite far from the Rockefeller and Bush Sr. tradition, he's got a bit more of the Reaganite in him as well. And so we see in one man the dualism of the Republican Party and in some ways a long-standing dualism in American foreign policy. The war on Iraq and the war on terror only bring that out and put it onto the forefront of the stage of American politics.
But Ronald Reagan rhetorically was born again, and he brought in the Christian right coalition into the Republican tent. But personally, he was a divorced Hollywood actor, and I think he was a much more pragmatic person. And I don't think he believed that stuff. But on the other hand, there's evidence that George Bush is born again when he says that Kim Il-jong, the North Korean leader, is evil. He believes he's evil.
And he's beginning to believe that some of our traditional friends in the Middle East, particularly the government of Saudi Arabia, may be that way too. That's, I can tell you've got some people in the political elite in Saudi Arabia very worried, as in Egypt, and they're wondering if, in fact, there is a sea change going on in the American government's traditional friendship with Saudi Arabia.
Have you noticed, Thomas Carruthers, in Washington, whether... I mean, surely somebody ought to be looking at the fact that within Saudi Arabia itself, the repressive elements, the Wahhabis, the Mutahaween, the religious police, and their backers in the royal family, are the minority. They're not very popular, and they're not popular in Islam, and you'll never have a reformation in Islam unless you kind of purge this xenophobic, hateful interpretation of Islam.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I think there is a feeling of, well, there's long been the feeling of after the deluge in Saudi Arabia, what might come and what might be worse. But people are starting to ask in Washington and say, well, in a sense, what could be worse? I mean, they're already bad enough what's going on with the regime there in terms of the kind of political extremism it seems to be permitting and even financing in some countries. And so why are we so worried about what might succeed? If anything, we need to bring some air and light into these processes. The more they stay bottled up within societies, then they fester. So in some sense, you're right. There's no easy cure for these kinds of currents of hatred and extremism in Islam, but maybe it's best to simply shake up the bottle a little bit and start letting some air into it.
But you've got the people in the control of Bekr Medina have never really taken to the Wahhabis. The Shia on the Gulf side where the oil is are considered less than dogs by the Wahhabis. So it's just extraordinary that, and apparently throughout modern Saudi Arabian history, it ebbed and flowed, the power of the Wahhabis. The Abu'l-Aziz put them to the sword. When the royal family seems to be the most corrupt, it seems to be the time when the Wahhabis have the most influence. So I'm just curious as to why, if we have the ability to have regime change, or at least the stated aim of regime change in Iraq, why not to go for the source?
Well, you're right. I mean, I think there is a hope by some people that a regime change in Iraq could stir up Saudi Arabia in a way that would get at what some people do feel is a deeper source in a way. But it's Saddam Hussein who's been the source of aggression across borders, who's potentially the source of weapons of mass destruction. So we should be careful about getting vague in our thinking about what is the source of the problem. We have much more concrete problems in Iraq that need to be solved, whether by military intervention or by inspection. Other things. The deeper problem of the source of Islamic extremism isn't something that you can, as we were saying earlier in the conversation, knock out with one military blow. It's a deeper struggle within Islam that's gone back to the 19th century, and it goes back to the 19th century. It's about sort of different currents of interpretation about how Islam should adjust to a modernizing world. So that's not something that we're really in our hands to change and to influence very directly.
So you're of the opinion that Saddam Hussein is more of a danger than I mean, the question would be whether he's worth the trouble. I mean, I think one of the reasons we're going after him is that we can. I mean, we can knock him off.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. I mean, Al-Qaeda is the biggest threat we face right now. They're operating against us. They've shown the ability and the desire to strike against us. They want to do more. So they're the biggest threat to us right now. And you're right. Saddam Hussein is not in an active mode of striking against United States. So Al-Qaeda is a greater threat to the United States than Saddam Hussein is, but he has also demonstrated international menace. Whether that means we should invade Iraq right now is a different question, but I'm just saying we have two major problems on our hands. One is more immediate and should get our primary attention, that's Al-Qaeda, but we can't ignore Saddam Hussein either.
And we can't ignore the possibility that going after him will stir up more trouble.
Stir up more trouble with our first problem, and I agree that that's a danger. Mm. There's a lot of hatred towards the United States that's feeding into Al-Qaeda, and it's possible if we invade Iraq, and particularly if it goes badly, that'll only generate further hatred. So I agree with those who say that our actions against Al-Qaeda should take our absorb our primary attention and energy, and it may not be necessary to go after Saddam Hussein right now. We should try to use all possible means against him, peaceful means, and if those exhaust themselves and are really not effective, then we may have to consider something more severe.
Well, let me just be skeptical here for a moment, because it seems to me that there are rumors that we were able to get the Chinese and the Russian and the French vote on the Security Council by promising oil. Of course, the Iraqis are saying we're after their oil. The Iraqi people, apparently, as much as you can poll them, believe that that's the motive, too. And they're not happy about that. So where does this realpolitik of oil and the faith-based politics of the Reagan-esque George W. begin?
Well, let's focus on oil for a minute. I mean, first of all, right now the United States actually buys a fair amount of Iraqi oil. We get 7 to 8% of our oil supply from Iraq, so it isn't as though we're not already accessing Iraqi oil. But yes, the United States and the Western world and the industrialized economies have a strong interest in a regular flow of oil from the Middle East. And Saddam Hussein, through his actions over the years, has shown, both with Kuwait and with Iran, has shown a desire to control Middle East oil. And he's clearly had the dream of an oil empire which he could have the West at his mercy. So neither the United States nor France nor even Russia have an interest in that happening. So the sort of sense that Saddam Hussein is an international danger is linked to his grand design that he apparently has to try to control more of the oil around him. But I think if he had not shown an interest in invading his neighbors or trying to acquire very dangerous weapons of mass destruction that would give the ability to blackmail his neighbors, we would have been willing to let him sit in his country and be awful. But because of his designs across borders and his own sort of plans for Middle East oil, which conflict with the West's interest in the oil, we're in the situation we're in. So, of course, oil is in the mix. On the other hand, it would be too narrow to simply say this is simply about the United States trying to get a stranglehold on Middle East oil. I think it's a broader issue about, is there a place in the Middle East for a leader who's willing to strike across borders and acquire these kinds of weapons in an irresponsible way?
Well, in closing then, Thomas Carruthers, back to the North Koreans who are now sort of tweaking the United States as it's preoccupied with Iraq, and George W. Bush has said in the tapes that from Woodward's new book, he said that Kim Il Jong is Kim Il Sung is evil.
Mm-hmm.
He believes he's evil. So the thing that worries me about a president who characterizes good and evil and operates from the gut, as it were, is once you've got through condemning the fact that this is an unstable, dangerous, blackmailing regime that's whose own people are starving, while this crazy guy lives in huge palaces with this grotesque cult of personality that he's developed, and it is a totally failed state, and it's just getting all this negative attention and threatening nuclear weapons so that somebody will keep this dreadful thing going.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get through all of that, you still got to deal with the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is what I'm concerned about, is that rhetoric is all very good, but at the end of the day...
No, I mean, I think it's possible to draw moral judgments on the international stage, yet still be practical in thinking about how to solve them. I mean, probably a lot of people in Denmark think that the leaders in North Korea are evil as well, but Denmark's not planning to invade North Korea or use military force against it. I mean, I think we need to separate the fact that there are evil leaders in the world doing terrible things, and whether or not that means when you go about looking for a solution, whether or not negotiation is still possible or other kind of peaceful means. And I think the jury is still out on President Bush, and we should be careful about rushing too quick to say he's very warlike and militaristic. Don't forget how many times President Clinton used military force during his presidency and was quick to launch cruise missiles when the United States was struck at by certain things. And so, I mean, I think President Bush is struggling to reach a point where he knows how to act on these views that he has of Saddam Hussein and North Korea and other things. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to push for, you know, what we view as the peaceful alternatives or reasonable alternatives to any kind of rapid militaristic action. But there are times when there is evil in the world, and there aren't many choices, and that was the case with the Taliban in Afghanistan, and I think what President Bush did there was probably well-advised, and basically was the start of trying to shake up the al-Qaeda's the empire they were establishing in that part of the world.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Thomas Carruthers.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Tom Carruthers, who's the director of the Democracy and Rule of Law Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. I'm now speaking with Arturo Valenzuela, who's the former senior director for Latin America at the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now the director of the Center for Latin American Studies at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And clearly, there's a portent for civil war in Venezuela. However, even though people are well armed on both sides, and they have these provocative demonstrations and counter demonstrations, for some reason or other, it hasn't really gone all hell hasn't broken loose. So, can you give me a sense of what is driving this problem and what is restraining it from all-out coup?
Well, the situation is very, very tense, very difficult, very polarized. There is a lot of animosity on both sides. The country is very, very polarized. I think that there's a standoff between two sectors of society, one of which supports President Chavez and the other that is adamantly opposed to his governance and has been so since the very, very beginning. They don't trust him. Chavez has not made things easy, either for himself or for everybody else through his fairly demagogic behavior, his style. He's reaching out to Saddam Hussein and Fidel Castro and others, his bluster, and it's just contributed to a sense on the part of sectors of the middle and upper classes in particular that he's dangerous and that he ought to be gotten rid of. Now, why is there a standoff now and no particular resolution? Because in some ways, the key to the situation is obviously the military. And the military, was split back in April when there was a sector of the military that they wanted to try to ouster, the president, by force. And, another sector of the military then refused to do that. Since then, Mr. Chavez has removed many of the coup mongers within the military, so the military is probably more loyal to him at this point. On the other hand, it's hard to see how he can really hold on over the long haul, particularly if the strikes in the petroleum industry continue to affect Venezuela's ability to export oil, and the key to government revenue, and in fact the key to the economy, is the export of oil.
But if Hugo Chavez's biggest sin is that he's a blowhard, then that's not an indictable offense, is it?
No, it's not, and this is part of the problem. That I respect the people on the opposition in Venezuela who vehemently argue that he is taking the country down to some kind of a socialist alternative or a dictatorial alternative. But the facts really don't support that. His bluster and his demagoguery have been much more than his bite, so to speak. And, this is certainly not a situation like the 1960s and 70s, for example, in Chile, where there was a wholesale takeover of the private sector of the economy by the government, where there were strong forces supporting the government, and where there was a clear indication that what was the objective was a socialist Marxist state. This is certainly not the situation in Venezuela. And despite the concerns among journalists and others who have been harassed and who have been intimidated, there's no question about that. If you compare Venezuela with Colombia, there isn't a wholesale slaughter of journalists. There aren't a situation where people have been arrested. There have not. In fact, Chavez has had to step down, to back down on many of these sorts of things. So it's a curious situation. He's not somebody, in other words, who's violated in a fundamental sense the constitutional order. And yet people want him to leave, and his ardent supporters want him to stay. So there's a real standoff.
And his supporters initially in 98 were overwhelming, right, when he got elected?
Overwhelming. There's no question about it. I mean, part of the problem is that there was a real collapse of the traditional parties in Venezuela. These parties benefited for a long period of time by high oil revenues. There was a considerable amount of corruption, and these parties became incredibly discredited. Chavez came in and essentially wiped them off the map. And many of these sectors who are tied still to the old parties in many ways resent the fact that they no longer control the spigot of oil revenue. And I don't have much of a brief myself for Chavez. But it's clear that he's a phenomenon that represents also the bankruptcy of the traditional political forces, who don't really have a very positive message or alternative to Chavez to put on the table at this particular point either.
So, when you're in the National Security Council as the director of for Latin America in the Clinton administration, I take it that you didn't look upon him with alarm.
Well, we were very concerned about him. In fact, I worked very closely with the current senior director for Latin America, who was then our ambassador in Venezuela, Ambassador John Maisto. And our policy was we need to be sure to make sure that Chavez stays on a constitutional path. And it was difficult because in some ways he was winking and nodding at the Constitution with huge amount of political support in the country. By winking and nodding, I mean, for example, that he pushed through a referendum for a constitutional convention that then changed the Constitution. And that really wasn't in the original Constitution. But there was overwhelming support for that. And then after that Constitution was ratified, he then ran for president a second time with the new Constitution and was overwhelmingly elected. It's difficult for me to understand how anybody could then be arguing that we need to somehow violate the Constitution again, because he violated the Constitution then. Particularly when there was a strong majority ratification of that process. Let me say this. I think that the fundamental problems of Venezuela have to be resolved within a democratic framework. I think the administration here in Washington understands that, although I'm not sure that their recent call for early elections has been thought through carefully enough, because that may take longer in order to get through a constitutional change, in order to have new elections, than the provision that exists already in the Venezuelan Constitution to have a referendum on Chavez's rule, which is could come up as early as August of next year.
Well, let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Arturo Valenzuela, who's the former senior director for Latin America at the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now the director of the Center for Latin American Studies at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Now, just at the coup that took place a few months back, where Chavez was briefly removed and he came back, the United States government, the Bush administration, did not take a stand in terms of valuing constitutional processes at that time. And it seems to me that, to some extent, gives rise to a lot of skepticism about the role of the Bush administration, and in particular, the Assistant Secretary of State, Otto Reich.
Well, the real mistake, in my view, and I said so publicly at the time, was that the U.S. administration while saying that it wasn't clear whether he had resigned or not, and the belief was in Washington that he'd resigned, and therefore that justified the United States supporting the people who came in afterwards. The real mistake then was that who took over after Chavez presumably resigned? It was a group of people appointed by the high command. Now, that did not follow the constitutional order at all. If in fact, Chavez had resigned, his successor would have had to been selected by the National Assembly. Instead, this new group that was, appointed by the high command comes in and says, we're going to dissolve the National Assembly and the Supreme Court. At that point, the administration said, oh, my gosh, they're going too far. They shouldn't do that, and they tried to persuade them not to do that. But the underlying point was that they were still accepting the legitimacy of a group of individuals who obviously were not there because of the Constitution and consequently violating the Constitution. Having taken that stand then, and then today maybe arguing that, well, we need to, you know, change the Constitution and have early elections, that opens up a very significant possible problem for the future throughout Latin America. If any time a president is beleaguered, if any time there really are demonstrations, if any time some people in the military say we want this guy out, then what do? We violate the Constitution, have early elections to get them out? You know, Latin America has presidential systems, and presidents aren't removed that way. If we argued in the United States that presidents have to have strong majority support throughout their entire term, and if the polls show that they don't have that support, somehow that means that we need to call early elections, we wouldn't accept that. And I think it's a very dangerous precedent for us to be saying that in Venezuela, despite the fact that we're all worried about the confrontation in the country.
Well, in terms of the role of Otto Reich, who came into for some criticism at that time of that coup, the brief coup against Chavez, his tenure now is in some doubt. There have been reports in the New York Times and the Washington Post suggesting that Senator Lugar doesn't want him to be reappointed. Do you have any inside?
Well, the problem there was that Ambassador Reich was never ratified by the Senate. He was nominated by the White House to be Assistant Secretary. The nomination went to the Senate, and the Senate refused to support his nomination.
Now, that's the old Senate, though.
That's the old Senate. But the White House went ahead anyway and appointed him as a recess appointment after the Congress recessed. And that means that he could then serve as an Assistant Secretary without Senate confirmation up until the end of this particular Congress. Well, this Congress has now ended, and curiously, there are several other people who were also given recess appointments, and the administration had announced immediately that they were going to ask for a new appointment for them. In the case of Otto Reich, he was given another designation and essentially removed as assistant secretary because he couldn't continue. And it's not clear that the administration is yet going to reappoint him, and this has been a fairly controversial thing. And you're right, now the Senate is in the hands of the Republicans, but it's not clear that Senator Lugar is necessarily going to want to try to go down a bitter bipartisan fight for this nomination. In a way, it's too bad, because part of the problem I think the United States has in Latin America is that there's no clarity in leadership right now either. We really need to have strong leadership in dealing with this area, and in some ways the administration has dropped the ball in that regard.
Because they're preoccupied in Iraq and with Al-Qaeda?
They're preoccupied with other things, and then they're not sending any clear indication of how they want to try to move ahead in Latin America. There are very few things in Latin America anymore that separate Democrats from Republicans. Most of the people who are running the policy now are people who worked with me, career people. They're extraordinary people. I have nothing but high regard for them. And Democrats and Republicans, now that the civil wars in Central America are over, don't really have that many differences. And we really need to work much more strongly together to try to get a clear policy going. And this is not going to happen if we continue to have these divisive arguments.
Yeah, but surely that what's going on in Colombia is a far greater, it's a real war, with real casualties. It's been going on for a long time. It's incredibly debilitating. It's tied in with the war on drugs, which has been going on forever and cost a fortune. So you could argue in the scale of things, it's a lot worse than Iraq is. I mean, Iraq is something that may happen, but this one is happening.
Yeah, I think you can make the argument that what we're worried about in Iraq is a future danger way down the pike, and a lot of people can disagree on the evidence as to when that future danger could come along. But you're right. In Colombia, there is an immediate danger. 90% of the cocaine that comes into the United States comes from Colombia. Colombia is being torn asunder by three different insurgencies, the paramilitaries, the FARC, and the drug traffickers. And it's a very dicey situation. I think, to the administration's credit, they've continued to work hard on Colombia there. Democrats and Republicans tend to agree, too, although there is a concern for the human rights situation with the militarization of the conflict in Colombia. But it is a very, very, very serious situation. I would agree with you. Venezuela is more intractable right now in terms of how you resolve a situation like this, but there hasn't really been that strong a continuity in policy, and that's a problem from the point of view, I think, of the United States.
Well, just in closing, Arturo Valenzuela, it would seem then if you have these intractable problems like Venezuela, where the country's polarized and it can't get off the dime politically. Wouldn't it lend itself then to the parliamentary system? Wouldn't that? Why do all the Latin American countries have the American type of?
The reason why they have the American system is because the American model was the only model available when the countries in Latin America also became independent. And one of the things that it's good to remind most people is that as with the United States, Latin America became independent at the beginning of the 19th century. So these are among the oldest independent republics in the world. And the model they had was, after the failure of the French Revolution, was really the American model, the Constitution of Philadelphia. And that's what they accepted. And while Europe moved away from monarchies towards democracy through parliamentary regimes, Latin America stuck with a presidential regime. And one of the key problems of a presidential regime is that there's no real way in which a failed president can be taken out of office, save through a process of impeachment, which is extremely complicated. It requires two-thirds. Why isn't the opposition in Venezuela talking about impeaching the president? Because they don't have the votes in the Congress to get rid of him at this particular point. Whereas in a parliamentary system where a prime minister has to have the confidence of just of the majority of the parliament, there is a safety valve. Also, in parliamentary systems, the figure of the president is not as important. Of the leader of the country. So there's here we have a paradox in Latin America. In Argentina, they're desperately looking for a savior. Venezuela found a savior. Now they're desperately trying to get rid of him, and they can't find the constitutional mechanisms to do so.
Well,
let's remember that Margaret Thatcher was taken out by the leadership of the Conservative Party in just a few days when they figured that she was a threat to the majority of ambitions of the Conservative Party. So in Europe, in a parliamentary system, a crisis of government doesn't become a crisis of regime.
I thank you very much for joining us. I'm afraid we're running out of time. I thank you very much for joining us, Arturo.
My pleasure.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masa, just speaking there with Arturo Valenzuela, a former senior director for Latin America at the National Security Council under the Clinton administration, now the director of the Center for Latin American Studies at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell. Bye.